Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 21st of December 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on the show this evening. And thank you very much for taking time to share some of your evening with us just before Christmas. I know it's been a busy time. It will be busy in the next few days, but this is a really important conversation. And Leith is going to share some very important insights tonight. So it's great to see everybody in there and on the show. Just before I bring Leith in, let me just go here and just remind you we don't provide financial or legal advice on this channel. This is a general conversation only. We do moderate the stream, so please play nice in the chat room. This is as at the 21st of December if you're watching in replay. If you'd like to ask a question, use that Walk the World to get my attention. That'll make sure that your question comes through. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which does two things. Firstly, if you want to make sure your question gets to the top of the list, that's a way of doing it. But also, if you'd like to make a contribution to help to support the running of what we do here, that's also greatly appreciated, and Super Chat is a way of doing that too. Anyway, without further ado, let me push this button. And Leith, are you there?
I am, Martin. Thanks for having me on, and hello, everybody.
Yeah, great. Great to have you on, and thank you very much for spending some time with us. Very exciting conversation. This your piece of work, which came out, I think, yesterday, is really, really important, and it'll be great to walk through it. But why don't we just get you to introduce yourself for those people who don't know, and we should underscore you've got a very, very strong connection with Nucleus Wealth.
I do, yes. I'm the chief economist at Nucleus Wealth with Damien and Shelley and co. And also the chief economist at macrobusiness.com.au, which is where I do most of my day job, as well as liaising with those guys. So, yeah, quite a busy life I've created for myself, but yeah, also very interesting as well. So I spend a lot of my time tracking mostly the Australian economy, but also the Australian housing market and a bit of political stuff and et cetera. So I cover a pretty broad range of issues.
You certainly do. Busy is to say the least. The number of posts you make a day, it's pretty amazing. You actually were inside, a number of large organisations before you went across to macro business and started throwing rocks at them. So it might be good just to underscore your pedigree in terms of and the switch that you've made, really.
Thanks for that. Yeah, sorry. Often when I'm on these shows, I assume everyone sort of knows who I am, which I probably shouldn't. But I spent my years before macro business, which I've been doing for 10 years, and Nucleus Wealth for the past three or four. I worked as an economist at the Australian Treasury in the early to mid 2000s for 3 years. Spent a year at the Victorian Treasury and then 5 years at Goldman Sachs before deciding to become a dirty, smelly blogger working from home with macro business, which I, my partner in crime, David Llewellyn Smith, and I run, along with Chris Becker and a couple other people. So been doing that for the last 10 years, and then obviously hitched a ride with Nucleus Wealth about 4 years ago. So I've been doing that too. So yeah, very interesting and busy times. Can't believe it's been 10 years already.
Doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself? And I'm just tweaking the audio just a little bit. People are saying it's a bit loud, so I'm just going to take your audio down just a little bit, trying to keep people happy. As with all of these things, it's I think the internet wobble has done something a little bit weird, but anyway, that's fine. We've got you back now. That's excellent. Now, coming into this conversation, then what we're trying to do here is just talk a little bit about what's happened over the last 10 years, but also what may happen over the next 10 years. And your high-level thesis is it's going to be the same old all over again.
That's right, yeah. So if you look at the data for the previous 10 years, so we're talking about the 2010s here, the decade gone just before COVID hit, and the Australian economy tracked okay at an aggregate level because we ran a very strong high population growth policy. But from a per person level, whether you look at, say, per capita GDP or you look at per capita household disposable income, the economy actually had its worst decade in 60 years of recorded data, where effectively living standards almost tracked sideways. And the sad thing about it is, I've actually got a chart there if you can, don't mind bringing it up. I think it's on the second slide.
Oh, the second slide. I pushed the wrong button.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. We can work that because it doesn't matter at all.
Okay, second slide coming up. There you go. How's that?
Third slide, I should say. Sorry about this.
Okay, let's try on that one. Third slide. How about that one?
There we go. Beautiful. That's it there. So what this is, this is basically measures the previous six decades that we had up until, obviously, the 2010s, which is the most recent. And the data is pulled from both the Productivity Commission and also the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And you can see there whether it's per capita GDP or it's per capita household disposable income. We actually had the worst decade in 60 years of data. And which might be a shock to a lot of people, or maybe it's not, because you know you lived it yourself. So we effectively had a decade where per capita living standards treaded water, or even though the overall economy grew, and that's because we obviously ran a very high immigration and population growth policy, which kept the economic pie growing. But everyone's slice of the pie had its worst 10 years in 60 years. And it was effectively one main reason for that, and that's because if you go to the next chart, the next section, next slide, productivity growth in Australia basically collapsed. Then we had shocking productivity growth over that decade, and over the long run, productivity growth is the key factor that actually drives up living standards. So when productivity growth stalls, obviously living standards stall. And what productivity measures is basically how much outputs you get from a given amount of input. So it's how effectively you use your existing resources in the economy. And the last decade, we actually had very poor productivity growth. And as a result, most of Australia's growth came from growing the population. And my thesis is that we're basically setting ourselves up for the same problem again, because there isn't any reason to believe that productivity growth is suddenly going to turn around, especially with the policies we've got. And also the other main way that the economy grows other than population growth is through increasing labour force participation. And what that is basically if you bring more people in the workforce, so whether it's, say, stay-at-home mums, people work more hours, old people work longer, you effectively also get more growth that way, but it's not as good as obviously productivity growth because you're working harder to get that growth. And there's a good reason to believe that we're not going to get participation growth in the next decade because the labour force participation rate, or the employment to population ratio, is actually at its highest level in history right now. So there isn't that much scope to actually increase that any further. So we're effectively left with this economy where productivity stinks. We're probably not going to get much more labour force participation because it's already at its highest level ever. So that's going to leave the economy relying on population growth again to grow, just like it was last decade, which is going to mean that per capita living standards stall again. Right. So it's a pretty depressing thesis, but we've published a report on macrobusiness.com.au, which has 29 charts and about 5,000 words explaining this in a lot more detail, but that's it in a nutshell.
And just to sort of underscore a couple of points, right, the first is, what you're actually, I think, saying is we've almost got a form of quantitative easing, right, driven by population.
Quantitative, right? Peopling is what, yeah, Phil Zeus calls it.
Quantitative,
which is
yes.
Fantastic. He calls it population QE.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's effectively been Australia's economic model last decade. And unfortunately, I was hoping that this COVID pandemic would lead to, you know, changed economic policy, long-term reform, less of that, trying to be more like, say, the Scandinavian countries, which actually try and do things better rather than just importing people. But unfortunately, the politicians are hell-bent on rebooting big Australia and basically just going back to the same sort of failed policies that they went last decade. It's a bit of a shame. So, and just to circle back to the 2010s, there's also other parallels here too. Just about all the growth you saw in those 2010 charts came in the first 2 years. Hmm. So it came in 2011 and 2012. And the reason for that was we were having a mining investment boom then, and as well as a commodity price boom. And from 2013 onwards, the commodity price boom ended, the mining investment boom ended. We effectively had zero growth for the rest of the decade. And I think we're going to have a similar situation this decade because we're going to have two pretty good years because of all the stimulus. And if you actually go back to the first slide, working backwards here,
So the real first slide.
Yes, that's right. So effectively, this underscores the amount of stimulus that's in the economy right now, which basically sets us up for a very good year next year. But after that, you know, who knows? But so I put a chart on the left here, and that basically shows that household disposable income so far during the pandemic actually boomed on the back of, you know, $200 billion worth of stimulus. At the same time as expenditure, household expenditure, which is the blue line there, crashed because of all the lockdowns. So people effectively got more money from all the JobKeeper, JobSeeker, all the other stimulus, rating the superannuation, early superannuation release, etc. That all counts as disposable income. So their disposable incomes went up in the short term, and they couldn't spend because of lockdowns. And what that meant is, on the right chart here, we've had an explosion in household savings. So effectively, Australians saved, I've got to try and squint down to 2020 vision here, but we saved $327 billion in the first 6 quarters since the pandemic. And that's up from $118 billion that was saved by households in the 6 quarters leading up to the pandemic. So effectively, Australian households have saved this massive war chest of savings because they weren't able to spend and they got all this stimulus, which will be likely unleashed in the economy in the short term, which will keep growth good next year. But it's what comes after that now the stimulus has ended. And if you go to the next slide, we've also got a current quite a large construction boom going on, which is again stimulus. The left chart there is effectively a proxy for home builder. So dwelling approvals, you know, obviously went up, but commencements and completions are lagging, and those will hit the market next year. So we're expecting all the home builder stimulus to hit Australia next year, which will support growth. At the same time, there's a massive amount of infrastructure investment expected next month. So next year. So effectively, the short term for the Australian economy is looking good if you just look at it in that narrow focus because of all the stimulus. But after that, once all the stimulus is washed through and the construction falls in an air pocket because all the demand's been brought forward, I'm tipping the Australian economy is going to have a very bad 8 years, just like it was last decade. From 2023 to the end of the decade, we've got no productivity growth. Labour force participation is pretty much peaked. So all our growth is going to come from population growth again, which means per capita, we're going to basically be flatlining again. That's the thesis in a nutshell.
And the other point to make there is Phil Lowe a few months ago said, if you want high wages, then keep population growth down, right? Whereas, of course, if in fact you bring a lot more people in, a lot of those low wage earners, that's going to be a very dampening effect on wages growth. And there's been very little wages growth for the last decade.
That's right. Yeah. So there was effectively zero between 2012 and 2020. And the bit that we got up to 2012 was because of the mining boom. So we obviously had a construction boom, which juiced construction wages. We also had national income boom because the price we got from our exports was so high, which inflated national income, and then that was filtered through to households and through tax cuts, etc. And we're in a similar situation now where the terms of trade, which is basically the Australia's effectively what it gets for commodities for its exports versus what it pays for its imports, is currently at its highest level ever, slightly higher than it was in 2012, but now it's starting to crash because the iron ore price has crashed. So we're effectively where we were in 2012, where we're going to have another good year because of stimulus this time, but then we're going to have the headwinds of falling commodity prices, and as well as obviously, you know, the stimulus is going to wear off because all this spending and demand's been brought forward. So, yeah, much of the same, and unfortunately, it means also likely stagnant wages. The federal government in last week's MIEFO, the mid-year economic fiscal outlook, predicted that wage growth would eventually go up to about just over 3% in the forward estimates in about 4 years. But if we bring back this big Australia large migration program and again start importing 180,000 workers every year, that's obviously going to keep labour supply rising, and it's going to prevent unemployment from falling low enough. The RBA thinks it should be 4% before you hit wage growth. And it's going to stop the unemployment rate from falling and tighten the labour market from tightening, which is going to hold down wages. So, yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, spurious situation the policymakers are putting us in, but it's all basically to paper over the cracks and give the perception that the economy is growing, as well as to line the pockets of big business, the property lobby, and the education migration industry. So unfortunately, those are the players that pull the strings.
Mm. And it's interesting because, of course, my view of MAIFA was authored by Hans Christian Andersen, right? I mean, it's that good. But there was almost no critique amongst the mainstream media looking at this stuff and saying, hang on a moment, you know, there are some really big assumptions here which don't make a lot of sense. And there's a bunch of, in Sir Humphrey's words, courageous assumptions, right? But really, if you look at this, a whole piece of work, you know, you can blow holes in it left, right and centre, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's... These budgets, these MAIFOs, are always a bit of a work of fiction. It's all about spinning a narrative, and they always assume that growth's going to go back to trend somehow. So it always they always think productivity growth's going to go back to the historical average, wage growth's going to go back to the historical average, and this is one of the reasons why the RBA and the Australian Treasury have basically missed the wage growth forecast for the last 10 years.
There's that wonderful
chart. They
always
have this sort of hockey stick, yes. Hockey stick of wage growth every time.
Yep.
And every year it's just like that. And, you know, it's because they have all these assumptions that assume everything will just go back to its long-term trend. But it doesn't happen when you run an economy like we've been running the economy, which is just all about importing people. Without trying to pursue, you know, productivity reform or other policies. So it's it is a work of fiction. It always has been, and unfortunately, especially this one, because it's obviously a pre-election document as well. So yep. You know,
well, we might come back to the politicization of the public service a little bit later on, but let me just pick up this one. This is from Lord Cookie Boy, who says, how do we increase productivity? And that's an interesting question, right? Because yeah, there's been a quest for productivity improvement.
Look, it is certainly hard. I mean, step number one is you don't keep doing the things that didn't work, which is, you know, you don't just keep importing people willy-nilly and crush-loading infrastructure. I'll get back to some of the things you can do, but I'll first talk about what they have been doing. So this whole big Australia model they've been doing actually, in my view, wrecks productivity because, first of all, you crush-load your infrastructure, which obviously has a cost to it. So congestion is a major cost. The cost of building new infrastructure is far more expensive nowadays than it was previously because places like Sydney and Melbourne and other big cities are already built out. So it means that if you need to expand infrastructure in a city to cater to a million more people, you have to do expensive things you didn't have to do previously. So you have to desalinate the water, for example, because you've got water shortages, which is very expensive. You've got to build tunnels. For rail, tunnels for roads, which costs a lot more than building roads and greenfield development. You've got to do land buybacks. So, for example, to build a new railway station, you might have to buy up 20 homes, which obviously when you've got the most expensive housing or some of the most expensive housing in the world costs a lot of money. So there's that. One of the other, there's an allocative efficiency problem you have when you run a big migration, big population growth policy in that, you actually encourage the growth of what I call people servicing industries over, say, export type industries. So if you look at a place like Sydney and Melbourne, the main employers now are all services jobs, hairdressers, your cafes, et cetera, and they're all low productivity because services industries they're almost never subject to foreign competition. They don't have economies of scale, so they're going to be lower productivity growth. And when you run this people servicing type model where you just bring in a whole bunch of people, build houses for them and sell coffees to them, you're going to actually create a low productivity economy. At the same time, you're also going to encourage businesses not to automate, because why would you bother investing in capital equipment and automation when you can just hire someone and pay them incredibly low wage or, you know, steal wages from them like we're getting with all the migrant wage theft? That actually creates a lower productivity economy. You know, there's a reason why if you go to a developing country that's building a road, they've got 100 people with picks and shovels, whereas in Australia or any other developed country, you have machines doing it with a dozen people. It's because it's more efficient to use machines than it is people just carrying buckets of rubble. And unfortunately, the sort of economic model we've got encourages this sort of low productivity type people servicing economy over, you know, an export orientated or you know, manufacturing type economy, which unfortunately we don't have. But circling back to how do you boost productivity growth? Look, it is very hard. If I could wish for the government to do one thing, it'd probably be to try and reform the tax system. First and foremost, I think that's probably one of the, well, not politically easy, but it'd be one of the easiest ways to get productivity growth. So you try and get rid of all the dud taxes that create a big efficiency drain on the economy, whether it's, you know, your stamp duties, whatever, and replace them with land taxes. You try and tax individual effort less. So whether it's personal incomes and income taxes, you try and move it to you know, consumption taxes, with obviously giving money to the poor, so it's not regressive. You know, back to land taxes. You could do, you know, carbon taxes, etc., to raise revenue to try and obviously mitigate pollution and try and convert the economy into, you know, renewables, etc. There's a whole bunch of stuff they could do on the tax front. Basically, dust off the Henry Tax Review from 2008 and actually implement a lot of the reforms instead of, you know, ignoring them would be the number one way. And don't continue to do what hasn't worked in the past, which is what we're doing. That'd be my two things. But apart from that, yeah, productivity is inherently difficult, and which is one of the reasons why it's actually, you know, it's slowed down a lot of places, not just here.
Yeah, I was just talking about the three Ps, right? And the fact that the three Ps determines how Treasury thinks about the whole problem, right? And in fact, of those three Ps, probably only one of them really is population, right? Let's talk about that a bit, because it is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. Well, so I used to work at the Australian Treasury, and in 2003, January 2003, about a week after the Canberra bushfires hit, I commenced work there. And Ken Henry, who was the Secretary at the time, basically pulled us all in there, and he gave us the induction speech on the three Ps. And I was too young to, you know, challenge it, I guess, at the time. But basically, the three Ps is, and it's the whole framework that Treasury and the government looks at how you grow the economy. And the first one is obviously productivity, and that's the one that matters the most. Obviously, if you can use your existing resources better and get more out of them, that's the best way to do it. The second P is the participation. So basically lifting the proportion of people that actually work in your economy. So whether it's, you know, older Australians who'd like to work but can't, getting them to work, or it's, say, your second income earners working more, whether it be your, you know, husband or wives who work at home, who spend more time looking after the kids, getting them to do some part-time work, or younger Australians in the workforce earlier. That's another way you obviously boost growth, because you're, again, using your resources, you're using your existing resources better or using them more. And the third P, which is unfortunately what our governments have been focusing on for the last 20 years, is population growth. And that's just basically immigration. So the more people you bring in, more inputs equals more outputs, you grow the economy. But that's not what matters. It should be everyone's slice of the economic pie. So it's easy to grow the pie by just simply importing people and bringing more people in. But if you're dividing that pie amongst more people, everyone's share of that pie doesn't grow. And personally, I'd like to see the three Ps become two Ps, just productivity and participation, and get rid of the population growth one, because it's pretty pointless. I'm certainly not an advocate of zero immigration. I'll make that clear. But I think immigration levels that existed pre-2005, which is about 100,000 a year in Australia on average, pretty much from the Second World War to 2004, is about the right level. And, you know, it'd allow our cities to grow at a, you know, reasonable pace that we can keep up with, and it wouldn't put too much burden on living standards, the environment, etc.
Mm. And I guess there's a broader point here. There is a fundamental set of philosophical principles which are driving the way that Treasury and other government sector entities work. You know, some people call it neoliberalism or whatever it is, but it's a sort of a market-driven philosophy, but also it's quite narrow. And the consequence of it is a very narrow-based economy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And again, it's sort of... we basically let the manufacturing industry go in Australia. And you know, we could have saved the car industry, we could have saved the other industries, well, the other ones that we've let go, if we wanted to. And it's been basically a philosophy here of Australia should just focus on its comparative advantage. Well, you know, and that's left us basically earning our export income effectively by digging up holes, selling commodities, which is fine because, you know, we've got a lot of that and that's fine. But then also, obviously, you know, agriculture. And then now we're trying to run this, selling education, which isn't really selling education, it's selling residency. That's effectively, because if you got rid of the carrot of permanent residency, we wouldn't be selling any education because they wouldn't come. But that's effectively, you know, the three pillars of Australia's economic, of our export model that we've got here. And we've effectively created ourselves a very narrow economy where that's how we earn our international, our foreign exchange. But everything else is just basically, you know, services jobs, whether that's, you know, consultants and your hairdressers, your massage parlors, all this sort of stuff, which is all basically designed, building houses for people, bringing people in and selling coffees, selling houses to them, inflating the cost of housing, selling debt to them, you know, giving them massages, personal training, all this sort of stuff. And that's all, it doesn't create new wealth in the economy. It's just basically, you know, spinning the tires, and it's all very low productivity stuff. And that's unfortunately what the Australian economy has become.
And just to pick up on that, right, because there's a couple of interesting concepts. The first concept is how fast the dollar goes around the system, right? And the second is what the multiplier effect is. In other words, you know, how much that dollar creates more dollars, right?
Yeah.
Now, the more you have a services-based structure in the economy, the harder it is to create any multiplier effect around dollars other than just blowing up debt.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I should also point out, this is a really important point that always gets left out of the sort of big Australia immigration debate, which is relevant here, is that if Australia earns most of its income by selling off its fixed commodities, which it does, you know, iron ore is by far our biggest export, and then you've got natural gas and all the other stuff, it makes absolutely no sense to then dilute that wealth, because Australia's got a fixed amount of these resources by so many more people. So, for example, the Intergenerational Report predicts that Australia's economy is going to grow by 13.1 million in the next 40 years to about just under 40 million people from just under 26 million currently. Well, obviously, if you're going to have 40 million people, everyone's share of Australia's natural wealth is going to shrink. It's going to shrink quite a lot. So, you know, in my view, Australia would be richer if we had 20 million people than what we have currently. And we'd be richer currently than if we have 40 million people or 60 million people or 70 million people, which seems to be the model, because unfortunately, the policymakers don't view the wealth in this way. They view it from just a purely, a GDP perspective, which is just a, you know, counting value added, not real value, economic activity. So, but it's not real wealth. It doesn't make us richer individually. And that, I think, is the key problem with the economy that we've got here. You know, very low productivity and also diluting a fixed endowment of mineral resources while also wrecking the environment by having more people and forcing people to live in smaller and more expensive housing, forcing people to live in apartments instead of detached houses. All this sort of stuff, and this is what's kind of has me worried, I guess, from a living standards perspective for my kids and their grandkids, etc. Because if we keep going down this road, we're going to be in this situation where everyone, unless you're very rich, is going to be living in a high-rise apartment in a crowded, packed city, working probably pretty low-value jobs.
Yeah, and unfortunately, everything that we see is that is the focus, right? And I guess there's a question here, which is a political alignment to it. In a way, both of the major parties seem to be dancing the same tune. I mean, there are minor differences, but I don't see really any stark differences between the two sides of the aisle on these particular issues.
No, in fact, I'd say almost the Greens are the same, unfortunately. The Greens sort, the Greens, I mean, there's small differences between all of them, so... you know, whereas Labor and the Greens, for example, would be more into, you know, zero carbon economy, which is a fallacy if you're going to keep importing so many people and have the population growth. grow so much, but they seem they're a little bit more into boosting renewables over fossil fuels, etc., which is great. But on the big issues, like the structure of the economy, they're pretty much on a uni ticket. Small nuances, differences between them, but it's basically, you know, Pepsi, Coke and Tab Cola, if you look at the three on these big issues. So unfortunately, unfortunately, there isn't an alternative voice we have. So when we all go to the ballot box, it's basically, who do you vote for? You're going to get the, pretty much the same result, no matter who you vote for. I always vote for just... just out of interest, I always vote for a party called Sustainable Australia, which I'm actually a member of. I've never been a member of a political party before. I don't care. I'm not usually into politicians, but this party at least has a reasonable sort of policy platform, and they kind of align with my views. But I pretty much implore anyone who's out there, when you get to the election, vote for a minor party an independent or one of the minor parties. Like, don't vote for the majors. Send them a protest, because they're pretty much, they're very similar. And your preferences will go to one of them, you know, eventually anyway, but you're better off sort of sending them a message that you're not happy with what's happening. And, at least use your vote.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I'm a great believer in creating a hung parliament, right? Because we can't allow either of the major parties to have, you know, a free reign. At least if you have a number of independents and minor parties who hold the balance of power, there's a bit more opportunity to hold them into some sort of balance and some sort of account. And actually, there's been quite a good track record in recent years of using some of that power to actually make incremental improvements. The problem I've got is that the amount of change you have to make in terms of the way that the political and economic structure works in Australia is significant. We've got to start somewhere, right? So in other words, the election that's coming up, this has got to be a really important testing point, because both sides of politics are precisely the same, give or take a few things.
Yeah.
There has to be a different model.
Give or take
10%. Yeah, give or take 10%, right? But that's not sufficient to warrant one or the other. Neither of them deserve actually a vote. So we have to go an alternative route. Hung parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, honestly, I'd like to see more independence in there. I mean, if you look at the, I'd love to see more Rex Patricks in Parliament. People like that who actually try and keep them honest and try and get, anti-corruption commissions in, etc., etc. More Rex Patricks, more independence, less, Lib Lab, Pepsi Coke.
All right. Now, there's a bunch of questions which came through earlier on. But let me just... put this one. This is quite an interesting one. This is from again from Lord Cookie. How much are we overpopulated by? So are we overpopulated, and if so, by how much? And you know, actually, net population is backwards at the moment from where it was a year ago, isn't it?
No, it's not. The actual immigration is, but the actual population still grew. It was just by about 0.1 or 0.2%. So it's basically flat.
Yeah.
Look, it's hard to say. Ken Henry, which is this is the hilarious thing. Ken Henry was the former Secretary of the Australian Treasury, while he was preaching this 3Ps, he actually, I think he came out a couple of years ago and he said he'd rather Australia's population was about 20 million. He might have even said less than that. But effectively, so here we have the head of the Australian Treasury who at the time was, preaching the 3Ps and trying to indoctrinate it into us, came out, of course, after he left Treasury and said that, Australia's population would be a lot better at 20 million. It'd be a lot more sustainable. So, and it, look, it's a debatable point. I don't know what the actual figure is. All I know is that, I don't know if the 26 million roughly is too much. But what I can tell you is it's certainly grown too quickly. It's grown by about 6.5 million people since the turn of the century, even with COVID, basically 6.5 million up to 2020 from 2020, which is pretty bonkers when you think about it, especially when I live in Melbourne and Melbourne's gone up from 3.2 million to 5.1 million or 5.2 million at that time. That's 50% growth. Sydney's gone up about 35%. So what I can tell you is it's certainly grown too fast. Infrastructure, housing, basically nothing has kept pace with the growth.
Yep.
And, it seems like the definition of insanity to then As the Intergenerational Report says, grow the population by 13.1 million people in the next 40 years, which is effectively twice what we did in the last 20 years. So think about all the growth we had between 2000 and 2020 and double that twice. So that's effectively what the Intergenerational Report says we're going to do. So if you thought that the population grew too fast in the last 20 years, well, guess what? We're headed for to double that again over the next 40.
Yep. The only, only policy in town, right?
That's right. So, you know, that'll see Melbourne probably 7-plus million people, and Sydney, probably 7.5 million. Sydney with maybe 7.3 million, I'm just guessing. But it's going to be a lot of people, maybe 8 million by that stage. And you can just imagine what that's going to do to do to livability in these cities. You know, the Urban Task Force released projections a while back, and at the moment, 56% of, well, as of 2016 census, 56% of people in Sydney lived in detached houses. By 2056, they said only 25% would. So the rest will be half will be living in high-rise apartments, and about a quarter will be living in townhouses, and only a quarter of the people in Sydney, according to the Urban Task Force, by 2056 would actually live in detached houses. So what that effectively tells you is that apartment living is going to become the norm. You know, great for high-rise Harry, but not so, or you know, Meriton, et cetera, but not so great for our kids and grandkids.
Yeah, and that is important. I mean, there's a couple of things I think about. One is the consequence for the next generation or two, right? And the other is the whole discussion of resource use, climate change, and all of those things. Because, you know, in the context of, the sustainable planet sort of conversation, just growing the population seems unsustainable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's about 7.6 billion people, I think, in the globe right now. And, you know, by the end of the century, it's supposed to be, I think, 10 billion plus. It's certainly slowing. But, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that there's too many people on the planet. Mm. There's no doubt about that. And we need to we just can't keep growing like a science experiment. And my view, I often have this argument with people. So people are sort of greeny type people say, oh, it doesn't matter where they live. You know, if they live in Australia, will they be living somewhere else? So what does it matter from a carbon perspective? Blah, blah, blah. That's fine. But the environment is more than just carbon. The environment is your habitat, how much open space you've got, all the other stuff that when you take a drive around Australia, you see that to me matters more than what the global carbon emission is. And the fact of the matter is, Australia can control its population through immigration policy, but it can't control the world's carbon emissions. So we should focus on the thing that we can actually control. If the argument is that, people coming to Australia, it doesn't matter because they've got to live somewhere. Well, you know, that's ridiculous because politicians are here to effectively represent their constituents, who are the voters, and they should be looking after our well-being, because we are their constituents, and the majority of Australians clearly don't. This big immigration thing is all the opinion polls say, so they should be representing us, but unfortunately we don't have a choice.
Yeah, and interestingly, as I think about this, and I sort of talk to people through my surveys, a lot of people, when they make a voting decision, make it on a very narrow basis, right? Which isn't about these broader economic or political trends that we're talking about. It's about what's in it for me, what's in it for my
pocket. Will my house go up?
Well, and I was going to say, and, you know, will I get more wealth from my property? That is a problem, isn't it, in terms of trying to actually draw any sort of change, because basically the politicians who are there basically just to get re-elected to do the same again next time can play that card knowing that a lot of people will, you know, dog whistle it and respond to it and will vote them back in again.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see it all the time. I mean, I've been called every name under the sun because I take a lower population stance, a lower population growth stance. Look, it's an easy way to shut down debate. And all we have to do effectively is pull out the, you know, xenophobia, race card, whatever you want to do, and that's easy way to shut down the debate. But it's not really fair, because I'm, because when we, you know, that's not what we should be doing when we're analysing these issues. It should be analysed from a, you know, from an analytical perspective. And it's pretty obvious. We've all lived it the last 20 years. Anyone who's been living in a major city, especially city of Melbourne, has seen the deterioration with their own eyes. Their basic, you know, living standards, whether or not it's, you know, driving around, trying to get from point A to point B, suddenly you're paying tolls when you used to be able to drive the roads for free. You know, the hilarious thing is, when I was growing up, pretty much nobody I knew going to school, and this is just at a primary school, like a state school, almost none of the kids I used to hang out with and play with lived in apartments. Whereas now, I reckon half my mates live in apartments, and I'm, you know, 44 in January. And it just shows you the difference. Like, we all grew up living in detached houses because our parents had houses, and suddenly this generational shift, you go 30 years down the road, and a lot of us are now living in apartments because we're forced to. And you just think, well, what's going to be like for my kids? Like, I've got a, you know, 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. In 20 years' time, if I didn't help them financially, they'd be probably renting an apartment, and that's their future. So we've gone from effectively predominantly, you know, detached house, backyard living, you know, this great Australian quality of life, to, in, you know, space of 40-odd years, to effectively living in these high-rise dog boxes. And nobody can tell me that that's not a dilution of quality of life, because it clearly is. And there's a reason why most people want a house. They don't want to live in an apartment, because, especially after COVID, because it is quite a big haircut in your living standards. And, you know, no amount of GDP or any other economic figure can get around that fact. There's a lot of stuff that statistics don't pick up, and, you know, quality of life is one of them.
Right, and this begs an interesting question, right? And I'm thinking of New Zealand here, as to whether, in fact, GDP is a sensible measure of anything in particular, right? Or should there be some other measure that ultimately determines what we do and don't do, you know, whether it's a wellness measure or something else? I mean, are we actually basically a victim of this narrow GDP philosophy, which we just measure a very small number of things, activity, essentially, right? Never mind the quality of the activity, never mind how well things are done, never mind how much waste is created off the back of that activity. It's just activity for the sake of activity, right? Do we need a different set of metrics?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, so New Zealand has been examining this, what they call a well-being budget. So, and it's not just from New Zealand. There's some other. It's been talked about in other countries as well, and effectively trying to get away from using GDP as the basis of everything, and trying to use these broader quality of life measures. And unfortunately, the Australian Bureau of Statistics used to release I don't think it was called Wellbeing, but they had like a national, so I just can't think of the name. It was like a wellbeing framework that a yearbook they used to release every year, and they stopped releasing it about 5 years ago, which was a shame because they were starting to get to that way of thinking. But unfortunately, you know, you'd have to get agreement about what you'd include in that, et cetera, et cetera. So instead, we're using this archaic measure that was effectively that takes no... it takes no account of environmental degradation, of, you know, all these broader quality of life measures that I just talked about. Also, you know, GDP is so ridiculous in other ways. Like, for example, you can dig something up out of the ground, like iron ore, exactly, example, and sell it, and it'll only count the what you sell it for, but it won't count what you've lost. You can knock down a perfectly good house and build another one that's almost exactly the same, and it'll count the building of the new house and the demolition as activity in GDP, but it won't count what has just been lost, which was a perfectly good house. So it's this kind of broken windows fallacy, they call it, where, you know, you can just boost output by breaking things and then rebuilding them, but that doesn't improve your quality of life. And unfortunately, that's kind of the framework we've got with GDP. It's just takes no consideration of these broader measures, whether it's pollution and, you know, environmental degradation, what you've lost in the process of what you've just done. It only counts, you know, the value add, not what has been lost in what you've been doing, or the opportunity cost, I guess. And certainly, you know, I hate GDP as a measure, but as part of my job, you obviously have to report on it and use it. But at least if we are going to use GDP, we should at least be measuring in per capita, and that should be the sole focus. Per person GDP is, you know, still not perfect because it doesn't count all these things, but at least it measures on a per person basis. And unfortunately, every single, you know, report, government report, every single national accounts release that the ABS does, etc. The headline figure is the GDP, is the overall pie. It's not everyone's slice of the pie. And that's what the media focus on. Like, you rarely hear the media, you'll never read a headline saying Australia's per capita GDP falls, 0.1% in March quarter. It'll be Australia's GDP grows 0.3 in the quarter when population growth's been 0.4. You'll never read that per capita thing. You've got to, like, read the whole article, and then at the back, if you're lucky, the mainstream media might do a line on it, but usually they just gloss over it. And because of that, we just end up with these crap policies that are all about juicing the headline number, spinning the wheels while we all basically tread water or go backwards. And the whole system's basically set up to fail in that respect, because if you set a key performance indicator that's broken, you're going to get a broken policies to feed that indicator. And that's unfortunately what we've got.
And I was going to say, it amazes me that, the economists that are linked to all the major banks and the independent economists and almost everybody else, they all get fixated on this GDP stuff, right? As though it's somehow a magic mantra. And then, of course, the politicians then parrot how well they've done because the GDP has gone up. And so there's this sort of mutually reinforcing cycle, right? And the Reserve Bank, of course, is as bad as well. So we've actually got everybody group thinking that this is actually the way to do it, when in fact it's taking us down a blind alley.
And it's even worse than that. So on the population thing, obviously, running a high immigration program, etc., will boost your GDP while your GDP growth, while your per capita growth stagnates. But it's even worse than that, because in Australia we've got this federal system whereby the federal government collects 80% of the tax revenues, and the states collect about 14 or 15%, and the local governments collect the rest. And we have this situation where, because the feds collect most of the revenue, they gain from population growth and immigration, because they collect the company taxes, they collect the personal income taxes. But the actual cost of growth, the cost of this population growth, is borne predominantly by the state governments, which have to fund all the services, because state governments provide most of the services, the federal governments collect the tax. So you've got this weird set of incentives where the federal government gains, the state governments generally lose. And the way the state governments get around it is, instead of investing, using taxpayer dollars in things like infrastructure, etc., they then privatise it, or they do a public-private partnership. Yeah. And all it does is it shifts it off balance sheet. And it means, like, say, in Sydney, you have 20-odd toll roads run by Transurban, which then fleece the general population. So effectively, if you're a taxpayer in Sydney, you're paying taxes to the federal government, you're paying some to the state government, but then you're paying this big wad of private taxes to companies like Transurban and all the other, private utilities, etc. And that effectively raises your cost of living, but you've only built all this infrastructure to keep up with the population growth, which you didn't need in the first place, which artificially makes the federal budget better while making everyone else worse. So it's just, we've got this strange situation where the incentives aren't aligned. And my personal view is, if we could somehow force the federal government to basically pay the states and local governments $100,000 per migrant, per permanent migrant that arrives, so we cover the infrastructure cost, I guarantee you Treasury and the federal government would backtrack on big Australia immigration very quickly, because suddenly they wouldn't just receive the revenue, they'd actually have to start sharing it. Which is why it'll never happen, but it should happen.
It's a remarkable picture that you're painting, right, of money going from one pot to the other pot, right, and people are basically chasing these various strategies to try and actually sustain their bit of the pie. No one's looking at it from an overall Australia benefit point of view.
No, and look, we all know it. I'm presuming probably at least, well, by numbers, at least half the listeners will be living in Sydney and Melbourne. And just think about it. How many tolls did you used to pay 20 years ago? You have the Sydney's Harbour Bridge, maybe one or two others. Now, you drive anywhere now, you got to pay tolls. And why do you have to pay those tolls? Because they have to build all these roads, because Sydney's population grew by 1.5 million people. And so has that made you better off? Like, to get from one end of Sydney to the other, you used to be able to just drive it and it cost you not much. And then now suddenly, it could cost you $20, $50, whatever. And it's purely because, they've privatised all these roads, WestConnex, all the other stuff. So did a private firm like Transurban, can come in and fleece you and build this infrastructure that you only needed because you brought in all these people that you didn't need in the first place. And it's the same with, you know, like we're now starting to see with water, because although we've had a very wet, you know, wet 2 years, it was only 2 years ago that Sydney was run out of water. And, you know, we've obviously built all these desalination plants, but part of the reason why you've had to build them is because the population's grown by 30 to 50%, if it's, you know, 50% in Melbourne. So obviously you need more water to cover that population. So you've got to build these desal plants, which now means your water bills go up. So it's this crazy situation we've got with ourselves. And can you imagine how it's going to be once we add another 13.1 million people in the next 40 years? We're going to have, you know, Sydney will be wall to wall. Like, by that stage, Transurban will probably have taken over the entire road network, because they would have done a sweetheart deal with the government, because the government's starved for cash, right? The New South Wales government's starved for cash. And they'll probably sell the entire road network to Transurban. We'll be living in this Blade Runner society, where you're basically paying for every single kilometre that you ride on or driving this private road, when, you know, by that stage, 50 years earlier, everyone drove it for free. And it's all because suddenly we've decided that Sydney's population has got to be 7.5 to 8 million people. That's the kind of situation we're going to find ourselves in under these stupid policies.
Mm. Well, as somebody said recently, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, right? Because basically you're paying for everything as you go, right? All these private taxes and everything else, as you say. But it's a bit of a nightmarish situation, but it's all because of the way that the economic settings and policy settings are determined, right? I keep saying to people, you've got to realise that this isn't just an accident. There's actually a set of theories and a set of policies that are driving these outcomes, right? Which means they could be changed.
Yeah, that's right. But unfortunately, the agents or the actors who pull the politicians' strings, it's not in their interest to do so. So, I mean, I always write about this cabal called it's called the growth lobby. And the growth lobby is effectively, you know, big business, the property lobby, I guess they're one of the same, but the property lobby and, say, the education/migration industry, so your universities, your higher education, etc. And they effectively, you know, you see it all the time. They're lobbying the governments, open the borders, you know, give us as many people as we can because it's good for their business. You know, bringing in people means you got more customers to sell to. It also means that you lower your wage costs because you've got a bigger pool of employees and you have people who are, you know, willing to work for less. And then you also inflate your capital. So if you own a lot of land and capital, will your assets go up as well? So it's a win-win-win for them. And unfortunately, they're the ones who have so much lobbying influence over our governments that I've become pretty cynical in my oldish age. I just can't see it changing, unfortunately, as much as I'd love for it to change, and I'll keep writing about change and hoping it changes. I just don't think it will, because they're just so powerful. And, you know, if this COVID pandemic couldn't stop this nonsense, you know, we've just had an 18-month pause in immigration and a chance to reset the whole program. What are they doing? They're going straight back to it. And we've got the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the Business Council, you know, the Phil Honeywood and the education, international education sector, and Harry Triggerboff and Housing Industry Association. And they're all going, we need more people. We need more people. We've got to, you know, we need a post-World War, you know, big Australia migration boom to get the economy growing again. They're the ones who are screaming the loudest. And unfortunately, they seem to have captured the federal government and all sides of politics.
Mm. And just on that, of course, they're running an inquiry at the moment on supply side issues in housing, right? Very convenient, because it doesn't really actually affect federal government, right? Because they can say it's the state's problem.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, it's the biggest furphy going around. So unfortunately, everyone's probably followed it. We've had about a dozen housing affordability inquiries in the past, since the early 2000s, I'd say. Since house prices rocketed in about 2003, we've had about a dozen housing affordability inquiries. And every time they hand down this report, nothing happens. A couple of years go by, we go through another cycle. They call another inquiry just to give the perception that they're doing something about it. And here we are again, another housing affordability inquiry, another fake inquiry. Although this one's a bit different. because this one, the federal government has basically predetermined the outcome from the start, and it basically blamed supply, blamed a lack of supply for a housing problem, which is an absolute furphy when you consider that we've just had zero migration for 18 months and house prices rocketed. And at the same time as the build rates have been pretty high and they're going to be high next year as a home builder. So obviously there's a whole lot of factors at play. Now, you know, I'd argue that big migration does obviously push up house prices more than it would otherwise over the long run. But let's be honest, the driver of this cycle has been the, you know, collapsing interest rates and easy credit, et cetera. There's no doubt about it. You can't deny it. It's actually been a global phenomenon. So everywhere around the world has gone through a similar housing boom because the cost of money has fallen. But this inquiry, and especially after the federal government's canned negative gearing reform, et cetera, it's a bit of a laugh to see them try and, you know, pin it all on supply and shed crocodile tears about affordability. Hey, Martin, do you want me to turn on my light? I actually didn't realize it wasn't on.
Yeah,
just one moment. I'll just step away
for a second. Yeah, good idea. You're getting a little bit gloomy now with dusk. see a bit of color change for a moment. Hey.
How's that? Is that?
Yeah, right? That's good. Yeah, yeah. If you
so
come
I'll
back.
Duck down because I don't want everyone to see that I'm wearing shorts. It was getting a bit bright here before, and then suddenly the sun's gone down in Melbourne. So.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's.
I didn't bother to think about the light.
I have to say, I was so engrossed in what you were saying, I missed the point that it was getting a bit dark as well. But anyway, that's fine. The point is, everybody heard what you said, which is the main thing. But that's a lot better.
Yeah. So yeah. I was talking about housing supply. Yeah. This joke affordability inquiry.
Yeah.
That basically, the federal government has predetermined the outcome. Have in the terms of reference said it's all about supply. I published a submission to it, just basically taking the mickey out of it and calling them frauds. It's going to be another inquiry, and it's basically just a free kick to the developers. It's just the coalition doing what the coalition does best, and trying to, you know, give a free kick to their property lobby mates, because, you know, it's convenient for them to say it's all about supply. They want, you know, lax planning, etc. They want to be able to just do what they want and profiteer out of it.
Mm. And of course, as with always, the terms of reference were, as you say, crafted very carefully to avoid the real issues. I mean, I know you guys put a submission in. I certainly put a submission in saying, how many inquiries have we had that have missed the point? Right? You all know what the issues are, but nobody wants to talk about those issues, right?
That's right. Yeah. I must admit, mine was more taking the mickey. So I didn't bother going into all the things that it is, because there's no point. It's all been done before. I just basically said, well, if it's supply, then why are you running? Like, why do you want to get migration back to 235,000 people a year? Well, isn't that the cause?
Yep.
But, you know, so it was basically just a smart aleck submission I did. just to be on the record.
And I think there's a few of those. I mean, even Saul Eslake's was a bit like that.
It was excellent.
Right? It was a brilliant submission.
Yeah, Cameron Murray. Dr. Cameron Murray's was fantastic as well.
Exactly,
just basically saying, well, why are we bothering? This is a farce.
Exactly. There's certainly a lot going on. Now, as we come into the last 30 minutes, there are a couple of things I wanted to walk forward to. One of them is the role of the Reserve Bank. Now, in Australia, in theory, the Reserve Bank is meant to be independent, right? And it's meant to be able to manipulate these various monetary policy levers to maximise the benefit to all Australians, right? So a simple question, are they?
Honestly, I think they're probably doing a better job now than they did, say, last year, because at least I've actually seen a bit of honesty about them through, you know, obviously, I'm pretty strong on the whole, you know, immigration thing and whatever. And you have at least seen the RBA come out and say that if we go back to big Australia immigration, it's going to hold down wages and it's going to stop us from being able to hit our wage growth and inflation targets. So they've been very vocal saying, we want to get unemployment down to 4% or less. We need to get unemployment down to 4% or less to get wage growth above 3%. And once we have wage growth above 3%, we'll get inflation sustainably within our 2-3% underlying inflation target. And they've been pretty good about that the last 6 months. They were hopeless for 10 years before that. But it does make me wonder, with all this threat of reviewing the RBA Act and doing an inquiry into the RBA's effectiveness, etc., I wonder if they've actually lifted the game a little bit in the last 6 months because they're scared of this stuff. But, you know, It's hard to say. The yes and no. I mean, I do have a bit of sympathy for them in that they've got a useless federal government that doesn't have their back, that doesn't do the policy that they should be doing. And they've basically deflected the running of the economy to the RBA through monetary policy, which is absolutely stupid. It should be getting done through fiscal policy. And because of that, I think I think the RBA, in their defense, has been caught between a rock and a hard place. I mean, they've got really, you know, one or a very small bunch of instruments. And if the target's to keep the economy humming, well, they've done what they have to do, I guess, by creating interest rates, because the federal government hasn't done its job over a long period of time. So, I'm not a huge fan of the RBA. At the same time, they are in a hard position because the federal policy's been so terrible.
So what about the Council of Financial Regulators? Because, you know, you've got this sort of mysterious body, right, which basically includes Treasury, RBA, APRA, ASIC, and a couple of other hangers-on, right? And it's interesting how people keep deferring to the Council of Financial Regulators, which, of course, by the way, is chaired by the RBA.
Yep, absolutely. And I used to write briefs for them, actually, back when I was at Treasury, would you believe? That was interesting. But it is a bit of a farce. I personally rather see the RBA shift to the New Zealand system. So the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is basically the joint prudential regulator and the central bank. And as a result, it has much better coordination between its policy. Whereas in Australia, after the Wallace Review in the mid to late 90s, we actually split the function of the RBA. We created APRA, APRA took over the prudential supervision, and the RBA is supposed to just do monetary policy. And I think that system has actually failed because they don't seem to coordinate properly. And I think they often work at cross purposes. And I'd rather see the RBA take a leaf out of the RBNZ's book and actually control both. And that way you'd see, you know, macroprudential policy and interest rates hopefully working in the same direction, or at least they'd be accountable for it, rather than be able to buck pass between the two. And I think we've got a situation in Australia where if everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible. And it's too easy, whether it's at the, you know, RBA, between the RBA and APRA and the Council of Financial Regulators to pass the buck, or if it's between the federal and state government, we've got too many layers and it's too easy for them to shift the blame on one another. And the RBA can keep saying, oh, it's not, that's APRA, and APRA can say, oh, that's the RBA, it's not our fault. And as a result, we end up with this, you know, nothing ever happens, or it doesn't happen quickly enough, or it's always reactive policy. I'd love it if we could cut and paste the RBNZ, boot out the RBA and put the RBNZ in Australia. I think we get better outcomes.
And on that, of course, the RBNZ was given a specific mandate to consider house prices in the context of monetary policy in New Zealand. It didn't used to be that way, but it was they gave that. And since then, they've lifted interest rates and they've done a few other things.
Yeah, and they've also done macroprudential as well. So they've sort of done debt-to-income ratio. The perverse thing is, here I am championing the RBNZ, and yet the New Zealand housing market's even more ridiculous than Australia. So,
well, I was going to make that point,
anyway, what do I know? I think I said last time I was on your show, the difference between Australia and New Zealand is New Zealand pretends they care. or they at least try. The New Zealand government has, the Ardern government has at least, you know, tried to scrap negative gearing. I think she's actually gotten too far, would you believe? I can't believe we've actually got sympathy for it. But, and they, obviously the RBNZ has just raised the cash rate. They've tried to implement a whole bunch of, you know, macroprudential policies, etc. Whereas here in Australia, we've done basically nothing. In New Zealand, they actually pretend to care, and but unfortunately, the actual outcomes have been pretty poor there. So they've had, up until a couple of months ago, they had 30% year-on-year growth in house prices, so which makes our 20-something percent look pretty mild by comparison.
Right. Yet in Australia, of course, the RBA says it's not responsible for house prices. APRA says not responsible for house prices. The Treasury...
Or APRA says that lending standards are sound.
Yeah. You know, like that one. Well, that's even bigger joke, right?
Yep.
And it goes back to precisely your point. Everybody can do that, right? It's somebody else's problem, and nobody can actually pin anybody down. That seems to me to be the Australian disease.
And also, we've got politicians that really don't care. You know, they don't. Especially the coalition. The coalition's now talking about, you know, more first home buyer stimulus today.
Yes.
So it's just like, well, you know, again, it's this definition of insanity. Like, we know that those policies don't work. I mean, they work if you want to juice house prices and you want to keep the Ponzi going, but they don't work if you actually truly care about affordability. And you know, but yet they keep going to these so-called affordability policies that don't work. And you know, New Zealand, at least to their credit, the government pretend, or they seem to care more than they care here. Here they don't even care at all. They, you know, they give it very light lip service, but then do the opposite. So yeah, it's a pretty dismal situation we have, obviously. But what do you do? I've sort of stopped worrying about it. I lost too much hair, as you can say.
Yes, yeah, and as Saul Eslake, a submission to that inquiry made the point, well, do the numbers, right? How many people actually benefit if prices go up versus if you drop prices, and, you know, how many people can't get in and want to get in? Well, actually, there's a greater number of people that actually think that things will be better if prices gone up. So therefore, that's all you need to win the election.
Yeah, it was always the two-third, one-third equation. So you got about two-third of people are homeowners, or homeowners in that they might have a massive mortgage and they're paying off. They don't actually own much home, but they're in the market, I guess. And, you know, a third of the people are renting. So whilst you have that equation, it's always going to favour, the two-thirds. So whereas if you went to Germany, for example, I think it's got about a 40% home ownership rate because renting's a lot more normal there. They have long leases, et cetera. Because of that, you don't get these sorts of policies over there because the constituency's primarily renters, so they don't do these sorts of policies. And unfortunately, it's one of the downsides of having a high home ownership nation, I guess, and a nation where the majority of rental stock is actually in private hands rather than, you know, institutions or government. So you get these kinds of policies which the politicians just play to the bigger number of voters.
Well, if you wait long enough, the home ownership rate will continue to fall, right?
Yeah, although just interestingly, I think the census that just happened, I think we might actually see a tick up this one, just purely like a short-term rise in the home ownership rate, but obviously structurally it's going to keep falling over time, but purely because of all the first home buyer stimulus that went out. We did have quite a big lift in the first home buyer mortgages, like a massive rise for a year.
Yep.
And that might be just enough just to give it a slight tick up to the home ownership rate. But obviously, structurally, long term, it's, you know, if you did it over a period of 50 years, it's going to be falling. Like a little blip.
Yeah, and if you look at the relative share of lending to business and lending for houses, right? It's going the same way. lending for houses going through the roof, lending business coming down, overall home ownership trending down, and the greater proportion of people who actually have property are leveraged through mortgages. So effectively, the mortgage component's going up and the one that's a home and hose, as it were, going down, so that more people are going to retirement with bigger mortgages.
That's right, yeah. And obviously the home ownership rate, they publish in the census, or the headline one, doesn't count if you're paying off a home. So, the home ownership rate 30 years ago would have been a lot of people owning their home free and clear. Now it's, you know, you own a home, but you've got a big mortgage attached to it.
Yep.
And you're carrying that very late in life.
Yeah, and they never tell you that the average mortgage is now out to 35 years compared with 25 years, right? So it's a lot longer. Going back to
15 years, it'll be 50 years. It'll be that, like last time we said, they want to put us on a subscription model.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Well, isn't that the point, right? And banks don't want you to repay your mortgage. They just want you to keep paying the interest, right?
It's just like Microsoft with Office, right? You used to go and buy it, you know, pay a couple hundred bucks and you buy it off, buy it free and clear. Now you pay $100 a year as a subscription.
As you do,
$365.
As you do with Netflix or road tolls, or, you know, wherever you look, right? That is the new model. The new economic model is you pay through the nose, folks.
Yeah, for everything.
And you will go on paying.
Yeah, we might as well just get barcodes on our head and they just
do
everywhere you go.
We won't take that much too further, given some interesting speculation about what people might be getting in their arms, but that's another story. Okay, here's one from earlier on, which is, I think, very relevant now. This is, again, from Lord Cookie Boy. Should we have a Norwegian-like government wealth fund, all the wealth from mining, etc., going into the kitty to invest for the country's future? Because we have a fund, but it's only to fund public sector pensions.
Yeah, it's very small too. Like the a couple of years ago, the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund. This is years old data, right? So it's probably way more than this now. So don't throw tomatoes at me. but several years ago, it was about $100,000 US per citizen in Norway.
Mm.
Actually, that might have been 5 years ago, so I don't know what it is now. But it was a lot of money. And effectively, and the Norwegian gas company, I believe, is now publicly owned. There might be several of them that they're publicly owned, so the public owns it. They own the asset. They get the they get the profit from it. And it's worth a hell of a lot of money. Here, unfortunately, the answer to the question is, yeah, I wish we did have that. And I wish when the Henry Tax Review was done, we actually did a proper mining super profits tax. But unfortunately, I think that horse has bolted. And I don't think we're ever going to get anything material, unfortunately, because basically our politicians are bought by the by the vested interests. But it would be fantastic if we had a Norwegian-style sovereign wealth fund. I'd love to see, the iron ore companies. It would be fantastic if they were the gas companies, if we had some publicly owned ones, but unfortunately, we don't. It's privately owned. We don't tax. We don't tax it properly. We don't do the super profits, and unfortunately, as a result, most of the profit that goes from our resources, etc., flows offshore to foreign owned, BHP, Rio, etc. Probably 90% foreign owned now. So most of the profit goes offshore. So we don't capture enough of the proceeds. We do get some, obviously, and I would love nothing more than to have the Norwegian system. But unfortunately, we don't. And just on that, it's interesting that the Scandinavian countries don't run the same population policies as us because they're smart.
Yeah.
If you go back to 1960, Australia had about 10 million people. Sweden had about 8 million. And now Australia's got 26 million roughly and Sweden's got 10.2. So Sweden's population growth went up 25%. Ours went up about, 150? Who do you reckon's done it better? I'm not saying we should have 12 million people now. It's probably not enough for a country our size, but the principle's still there. Like all the Scandinavian countries run this sort of low population growth model, but they try and have a high value add economy, heavily manufacturing based, smart economies. And as a result, they have some of the highest living standards in the world. Obviously have good government that provides great, social structures, etc. We unfortunately do the opposite. We've got pretty poor government. We obviously run this sort of population Ponzi type economy. We have low productivity growth. If it wasn't for the fact that we've got all this mineral wealth, we probably would be borderline developing country. So it's a shame, and I'd love for us to follow the Norwegian or the Scandinavian model, but I just can't see it happening because it's hard enough to get it's hard enough to get anything done here with this three levels of government we've got and the political system we've got.
Exactly right.
And it's pretty pessimistic, I know.
But it's a realistic assessment because basically the Scandinavian philosophy and approach and the way that they actually do a whole bunch of things allows them to make those investments in the strategic future of the country, right? And there's a very strong collective agreement that that's actually worth the investment, right?
Absolutely, yep.
So there's a different social contract between government and the community. We don't have that.
No, and unfortunately, I can't see us getting that either. Not under the system we've got. So, Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, I don't think a lot of the people. I mean, basically, we've got a sort of captured politicians, we've got a captured media, and it's only sort of alternative outfits like yours and mine, and a few others that actually try and question these things. And unfortunately, the structures we've got, the media we've got, it's all vested interest, and it's a game of mates, as my friend Dr. Cameron Murray would say. That's the whole structure that we've got here.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I used to get annoyed about it when I was younger and I had hair. And, you know, when you're young, you're sort of like, yeah, let's change the system, this sort of stuff. And fortunately, I'm turning 44 next month. And I've been, I guess, tracking this stuff for 10 years. And now I've just kind of accepted it to a degree. Like, otherwise, you know, you know, it'll just drive me crazy.
Mm. Well, I've often said, Leith, that step one is at least trying to shine a bit of light in the cracks, right, to show what creepy crawlies are there and how they're actually doing what they're doing, right? That's a really good first step. And actually, what you do on Macro Business and what I do here and elsewhere is to try and at least get people to understand how this is happening and what some of the things that are below the surface that you're actually driving those outcomes. Because a lot of people say to me they don't understand why it's the way it is. Well, we've sort of explained that, right? Obviously, the next step then is to say, well, yeah, but what do you do about it, right? And the what do you do about it gets complicated, because then you have to go into touch into politics and you have to touch into economics and a bunch of things. And then if there isn't a collective will to want to change, it's very hard to make change work, right? Because basically you can just continue the status quo for a lot longer than you know, than not. If people are happy, you know, and the house prices go up and everything seems reasonable and the sun's shining and the beach looks nice, well, that's good. But there is a point where you've got to ask those deeper questions, and sometimes what I'm trying to do on this show, at least, is to try and sort of move the conversation forward to say there are things that we could do and there are levers we could pull that could actually get a different outcome. Because, you know, I don't want to give up on the fact that there is an Australian story that we could be telling, which would be a lot more powerful than one we've got.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, that's pretty much what I do every day when I get up and write. But it does feel like I'm writing satire a lot of the time, though. Because some of the stuff, you know, I start work and I go, you read it, you just go, what? Yeah. And honestly, sometimes you think, oh, no, policy couldn't get any worse than this. And then the next day, it's worse. Or you know, a week later, you go, well, yeah, it's really... You know, I thought it jumped the shark 2 years ago, and then now it's like just so much worse than I ever thought. I must admit, I had this joke with my partner in crime, David Llewellyn Smith, a while ago. I said to him, you know, at the end of the Howard era, I was like, man, politics has gotten bad. And now I look back on the Howard government, even at the end, I was like, they were so good compared to what we've got now. Like, at least you knew. I mean, I'll probably get tomatoes thrown at me again, but I'm just comparing to the current mob we've had or what we've had since. We've had this steady degradation of, you know, federal government ever since Howard left. And it was bad enough at the end of Howard's term, in my view. There's a lot of, you know, structurally bad policies that were brought in, you know, by John Howard that we're still paying for to a degree today. But ever since then, it's like, if you were to compare the last term of that government to what we've got now, it seems 100 times better than what we've got now, because that's how bad things have become. Yes. And it's like, you know, it's amazing to say that it's just when you think it can't get worse, it gets worse.
Mm. But you see, it's not just here, though, is it? But it's not just here. You can see the UK, for example, where you know, I would say that the same degradation is happening there.
Oh, the US.
The US, right? So there is something fundamentally flawed, which is meaning that these, you know, politicians and these, you know, neoliberals can just drive this this thing through and basically ignore everybody.
Yeah, it does make me wonder if it's because it's run by it's basically kleptocracies now, where you got these powerful elites. Like, I hate using that term necessarily, because I was the elites, but, you know, whether it's, you know, big tech or it's you know, this handful of billionaires, whatever, have got so much influence now that they basically corrode the lobbyists have gotten so much money goes into lobbying now, and so much resources goes into lobbying now, that it just perverts everything. Yeah. And I think it's a Western disease we've got, unfortunately. Oh. Well, I mean, maybe not in Scandinavia as much, in some European countries, but certainly in the Anglosphere, it's you know, it's been a steady corrosion across the board.
Yep. I think it's a race to the bottom, unfortunately. Now, this is a very good question. It's nice to bring this into the towards the end of the show. What does the next financial crisis look like? And in that context, I want to talk about Fed raising rates or not. Will the Reserve Bank raise rates or not? And if rates do get raised, what does that do? Is that going to create a financial crisis, or is that because things are wonderful and therefore rates can be risen, brought a lot higher than where they are?
Well, it's a good question. I've sort of formed this view, and you know, I don't know if it's correct. Like, as you sort of form these theses, and it could very well end up being wrong. But it's just in some ways, I think the reboot of the whole big Australia pre-COVID levels of immigration or higher is actually a tool to perhaps suppress inflation and to keep interest rates lower for longer. And the reason why, bear with me while I explain this. So the RBA has said repeatedly, and I think they're right, they said that that we've got to get unemployment down to 4% or below to generate wage growth above 3%, which is required to lift inflation to its target. Now, it's historically, we've had to have wage growth between 3 and 3.75% in order to get for the Reserve Bank to hit its inflation target. Now, if we go to this back to this big Australia, big immigration program, we're not going to get wage growth. I don't think we're going to hit the RBA's wage growth targets. Unemployment, that's because unemployment is going to be remain elevated because we're going to keep lifting labour supply so much. And that could potentially mean that the RBA doesn't need to lift rates to anywhere near the degree that it would otherwise. So it is possible that we could end up, if they run this big Australia thing long enough and hard enough, that, it's been 11 years since the last interest rate rise, I think it was, about 11 years. We could go a long period without actually ever rising. Well, not rising again for quite a period of time, which could keep the whole debt-based economy going for a bit longer. So, I think you're right in that I think the next financial crisis will come by accident, if it does come.
Nope.
So it'll be because, for example, like New Zealand's doing at the moment. New Zealand's actually raising rates and tightening macroprudential. I think they've got a real risk of a pretty big property correction next year because prices ran up 30%, and they're now tightening, and it doesn't take much to tilt it and to turn it in reverse as long, the same time as they're basically scrapped the negative gearing. So I think it could come, if it does come, it will come by accident. They'll tighten too hard at the wrong time or some sort of policy like that, and then that'll create the economy won't react the way they think it will, and then suddenly you're caught with your pants down. A bit like what happened in the early 90s when we had the recession we had to have because the RBA jacked up interest rates to 13 or 17%. So I think if we do get it, it'll be an accident, but at the same time, going back to this big Australia immigration could keep interest rates lower for longer than you think, purely by suppressing wages. And wages are the key input to inflation. But then again, could very well be wrong. So if I am, don't throw tomatoes at me. That's just seems pretty logical.
Yeah, and some people were saying, well, what about China? China definitely, what's happening there could cascade over here and create significant economic disruption.
Certainly, China's stimulus. So they're talking about doing more stimulus, etc. But this time, the stimulus doesn't look like it's going to benefit Australia as much.
Mm.
So they're sort of trying to get away from this, just building empty cities type thing.
Yep.
And obviously, building empty cities has been great for Australia in that it's inflated the iron ore price went up to about $240 recently, $230, which is the highest on record. It's now down to about $110, I think. Australia is highly reliant on China's stimulus through our commodities, and they seem to be wanting to shift their stimulus to non-construction means, which means less iron ore and coal and etc., which could cascade on Australia. And obviously, they want to. We've got this sort of phony Cold War going with them, so they're trying to obviously cut their imports from us in certain areas like wine, et cetera, et cetera. So, certainly that presents a headwind for us. But I don't think that on its own would be enough for to send the economy in a tailspin. I think it's got to be something on the monetary side, given how much debt we've got.
Don't talk about the debt. It's a big number. Yeah, absolutely. Just in terms of taking that slightly further, one of the other questions, of course, is with policy misstep, right? It seems to me that both the Fed, the Bank of England, and even the Reserve Bank is in the between a rock and a hard place, right? And it's almost they want to go one way because they'd like inflation to run higher, because inflation, if it runs higher, would deflate the total value of the debt, right? Unfortunately, if rates go up, the cost of the debt goes up, right? That's a problem. And, of course, there's also the question of the inflation-deflation story there. Ultimately, the sort of where I was heading to is I've still got in the back of my head, we could actually end up in a much more deflationary environment in the next 2 to 5 years than many people see, because as you lift rates and as you try and deal with some of these other issues, all the stimulus that's been sloshing around the system for quite some time is going to start dissipating. What's your perspective? Do you think deflation is, you know, a real risk or not?
Yeah, possibly. Certainly this stimulus, if you pull the plug on it, it's going to the US and other places, they've had a similar sort of boom in household savings like we have because of stimulus. But eventually that'll wash out of the system, and it'll probably be, it might take a year to do it. But it gets back to the other point. If the central banks, governments, etc., make a mistake and they try and tighten, too hard, when the underlying economy is actually pretty fragile and they think it's stronger than actually it is, well, that's when you're going to have the next problem. And yeah, I can certainly see, that's a potential in the next year or so, that the global economy hits that, maybe the US. But this is all impossible to predict. I used to think, watch X and Y, and then that equals, Z. But nowadays, it's like I've almost given up trying to predict which way the economy is going to go, because it's just there's just always stuff you don't see.
Yeah.
Certainly that's a risk, and I think we are in a dangerous position now, in that. Economies and central banks are looking at tightening, and we don't know if it's the right thing for them to be doing. And especially if a lot of the inflation is actually sort of cost push inflation. So, if inflation is from excess demand, it makes sense to tighten because you need to dampen that demand. But if the inflation is because the cost of materials, etc., has gone up, well, it's not a demand issue.
Yeah.
And raising interest rates isn't going to solve that, because whatever, if it's semiconductors or whatever, that's in shortage. It doesn't solve that. And there is a risk that they treat, a cost push inflation issue with higher rates when underlying demand's not high, not sufficient. It all remains to be seen. It's been very hard. I've been watching, what's going on overseas. I'm mainly focused on Australia, but I've been sort of watching on the sidelines, and it's really hard to get a read what is actually pushing this stuff. Is it mostly cost inflation? Is it mostly demand inflation? Those are answers that I think we won't know until after the event.
Well, you see, I have a theory, and this is perhaps as we come to the end, this is more a political discussion than it is an economic discussion. Right. So if you look at what Biden is doing and what the Fed is doing and, what the Eurozone is doing or what the UK is doing, let alone Australia, decisions are being taken which have an economic overlay on them, but they're actually political decisions. And it comes back to this fundamental point that actually, the economics of politics and the politics of economics have got all scrambled up. So we've actually got people pulling levers and making decisions for political outcomes rather than actually economic outcomes. That's a problem, I think.
Totally. I think it's I think we've seen that with the COVID management, etc. A lot of it's politics is creeping into everything. It's not always based on evidence or anything, and that's the same with all sorts of politics now.
Yep.
It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake half the time these days when you read stuff, so and I do this for a living, so I'd hate to know what it's like for just for your casual who just reads the odd article here and there to know what's going on.
And, you know, as Mike says, well, what do you need to get out? Well, the first thing is to try and actually understand more about what's actually going on, right? So step one, as I said, is to start questioning and start not just swallowing the sort of the top line story from the mainstream media. Look at some of the data and look at some of the things that are driving the outcomes, right? That's step one. Then step two is to begin to think about what can be changed. But we're not even off step one for most people, you know, when I have conversations with people. So that's why these conversations are so important, to help people to sort of see things differently, right? And I'm a philosopher by training. And for me, if I can help people sort of, you know, turn it around and look at it differently, then in a way that is a really good first step.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because Dave Llewellyn Smith, my partner in crime, he's actually got a similar background as well. And certainly, both you and him look at issues in a different way to, say, I would, because I've been training economics, etc. It's interesting. I tend to find the often historians and people who do philosophy, etc., actually have a better understanding of a lot of issues than people who are trained in, formally trained in this stuff. Because probably because you're not indoctrinated and you got a wider view of things.
Yeah, well, I just keep asking the why question, right? I mean, that's what philosophy does. It keeps saying, but why, right? And sometimes that forces you to go further than perhaps the first order or the second order. But interesting thing.
It is. And actually, that's one of the problems with economics. And I say this all the time. I don't want to... There's a certain think tank... centrist think tank in Melbourne, run out of Melbourne, near Melbourne University, starting with G. That and the second word I. that I continually have issues with, because it always focuses on issues from a silo perspective.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, housing supply, we don't have enough supply, we need to do this.
Yep.
Carbon emissions, oh, we've got too much carbon, we need to do this. And then there was one on social housing last week. Not build enough social housing. And they do all this stuff, but then they'll release an immigration report saying, we need more immigration, we love immigration, bigger, better.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that doesn't equate with X, Y, Z that you complain about incessantly, all these different issues. Why don't you, instead of looking at it in silos and each issue as they're separate, you got to look at the whole.
Yeah.
And knowing that by you supporting this over here, you're destroying all your goals in this report, this report, this report, this report, this report. And I think that's a broader issue we've got everywhere with a lot of policy. It's not holistic, unfortunately. So we look at these little issues in isolation, but you don't look at how the sum of the parts affect the whole, or the whole affects the sum of the parts.
Everything is connected, right?
That's right.
And that's the complexity, because then, of course, you create a more complex economic scenario and model that you can't actually model. Because by definition, it's too complicated, right? So, and that's actually where economists start pulling their hair out. No disrespect. Because
I get disgusted by my profession, to be honest with you. It's probably the reason why I've gone on my own, doing my own thing. Because most economists are either paid shills, so they work for an industry which they're paid to toe the industry line, or unfortunately, most are compromised in one way or another. And that's just the nature of it, unfortunately. So, it's the reason why I guess I'm often more at war with a lot of them, and a lot of them don't like me. So,
well, there you go. As we said earlier on, just before you came on live, you know, the social media comments, just water off a duck's back. You just carry on, right? Because it's important. Leith, I want to say thank you very much. It's been a really interesting conversation. The conversation in the chat was also extremely positive. People were very keen on what you were saying. So you must come back and do another one down the track. It would be great if you could. And if they want to find out more about macro business, they go to what, macrobusiness.com.au?
Yeah, that's the best place. Just go to macrobusiness.com.au. We put up content every day except the weekends. We just work 5 days a week. We're a bit weird in that way.
But only five. Oh dear.
yeah, that's it. So we at the moment it's just myself and another guy, Chris Becker, who's running it, because Dave's having a holiday. But and we'll be a little bit light over Christmas, New Year. But we're, apart from that, we run basically 360 days a year, except for the weekends. So 250. So you can find me there. Martin, I appreciate being on here, and I'm very impressed impressed with the way you run this, because it's hard enough me just talking, let alone trying to run a podcast, doing chats, getting all this stuff going and operating screens. I don't know how you do it, to be honest with you.
Well, you see, I did push the wrong button at one point and shut myself off, but, you know, occasionally I push the wrong button. There's a bit of automation that goes on, but I've been doing it for a bit of time. But hopefully the experience as a somebody who was participating wasn't too bad for you. And
No, it was good. But I must admit, I saw some text come up on the screen. I actually missed a lot of it because I was having trouble thinking about what I need to say.
Yes.
And then also reading, because I can't do two things at once. My wife often says to me, I'm great at doing a single thing. Like, I'm a solo guy. I'm great at thinking at, like just banging out an article and having nothing else around me. I can't, hear anything in the house. But I'm very bad at multitasking today. So hats off to you. I'm very impressed with the way you do this.
Thank you. I mean, my analogy is I'm a pianist. I play the piano, right? So I'm doing multiple things with multiple fingers at the same time. So that's the sort of the way that I do it. Thank you very much, Leith. Really hope you have a great Christmas and a great new year. And we look forward to having you back on the show down the track. I'm going to take you offline now. And thanks very much. See you safe.
See you later. Thanks very much. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening, and have a great Christmas and a safe Christmas.
Cheers. See you later. So there you go, guys. Now, doggy cam, there you go. Somebody was asking about doggy cam earlier on. There you go. So that's your doggy cam, Lord Cookie. Hope that's good there. I'm afraid they've been sound asleep all evening, but there you go. And just in terms of next week's show, in fact, I have Damien Klassen coming on, and we're going to talk a little bit about the markets over the last year, what's going to happen next year, and maybe pick up some of the thematics in terms of which areas in the market actually are worth thinking about now, because there's some interesting stuff going on, some uncertainties going on, no sound to rally probably, so that'll be interesting next week. And as I come to the end of the show, I just want to say again, thank you for all those who've sent comments with regard to Jill, just to say again that her comment on the drum, that's just a screenshot. If you've not seen it, go and look it out. She's speaking there about mesothelioma, asbestos, and why, although she's dying, she wants people to be aware of it. So again, I would suggest that that's worth thinking about. And listening, we're trying to get the message out that asbestos is a killer, but it can also be something that can make a huge difference if we can get rid of it. So thank you very much tonight. Have a wonderful Christmas. We'll be back next week with Damien after Christmas itself. And then the week after that, I've got Tanya LaCantra coming on. So there's plenty more coming soon. Thanks for your time this evening. And keep safe. Have a good Christmas. We'll see you soon. This is Marty North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.